Inside Chicago Government. ShyGov.com.
Welcome to another in a series of interviews with Ben Jarofsky. I'm Dave Gloetz. Ben writes on government and politics for the Chicago Reader and hosts a talk show on WCPT Radio. And he's here with me in the studio. Thanks for talking to me today, Ben.
Hey, we've already talked. This is like our second time we've talked. You're just on the radio show.
That's all we do, man, is we just talk. Yeah. We go on a bike ride occasionally.
Twice in the last 10 years.
Probably won't be doing one this winter, though. You never know.
Yeah.
You might want to get some like hands-on training.
As you know, I only bike to get from point A to point B as opposed to bike for recreation. That's not my thing, man. It's just, I got to go here to there. I'm going to take my bike. So.
Well, today we're talking about your article that appeared in The Reader on November 23rd, 2017, titled Forrest Agonistes. Online, it's called Forrest Claypool Pulls a Jeff Sessions, which is not as an obscure literary reference.
I want all you John Milton fans out there to go look up Paradise Lost.
Look in Wikipedia, folks. You'll find it. And this article is about a letter disclosed by Chicago Public Schools from its chief executive officer, Forrest Claypool, to CPS Inspector General Nicholas Schuler. In the letter, dated November 17, 2017, Claypool apologizes for not remembering that he'd ordered an outside lawyer to change the lawyer's invoice to obfuscate the description of the service that the lawyer had provided. And this has to do with a bunch of lawyers involved in the story.
Goodness,
one is there's the chief legal counsel for CPS who Claypool hired. The issue is whether he can, according to CPS regulations, manage another outside firm of lawyers that CPS hired to do some litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And that chief legal counsel for CPS is getting a retirement stipend from them. So it seems like that's ethically not kosher. And Claypool tried to get a ruling from another outside attorney that said that was kosher.
Yeah,
and he went through seven attorneys till he found one that...
Six. He went through six, and then the seventh gave him what he wanted to know.
And one of those six, the subject of this article is he was confronted by the inspector general around having changed an invoice so it didn't look like he was consulting the lawyer to make this ruling.
Yeah.
And Claypool, when he wrote this letter to the IG, he appeared to be doing preemptive damage control around whatever future findings that the IG, Mr. Schuler, will make. I want to talk a little bit about the relationship between Forrest Claypool and Rahm Emanuel, just to give listeners an idea of why is this guy head of Chicago Public Schools? One of the things I came across was the 2008 FBI transcript of a conversation between Rahm Emanuel and then-Governor Rod Blagojevich.
Did we talk about this back in 2008?
Well, that's when the conversation took place.
I wrote about it in 2009 because I think it didn't become public until after. Well, obviously, it didn't come public at the time.
Yeah, it did come public for quite a while. At the time, what was public was the sort of the famous F-bomb that Blago threw down around, you know, he was gloating that he had the Senate seat to use as currency.
F and Golden, I believe.
It was F and Golden, So this conversation happened about a month before, the one that we're talking about now, happened about a month before he was arrested in November 2008 by the FBI. And in this conversation, Emanuel had called him up and left a message, and the conversation in question is one where Blago called him back. Mm-hmm. And Emanuel was currently U.S. Representative to the 5th Congressional District. Barack Obama had just been elected president and had just picked Rahm Emanuel to become his chief of staff. So then Congressman Emanuel was contemplating, well, I've got to leave my congressional seat, and what am I going to do? And this conversation describes it. And I thought we might do a dramatic reading.
Oh, my goodness. I thought you were going to play the tape, but we'll do it.
No, there actually is no tape. There's only the transcript.
I see. They played the tape in...
in federal court.
In federal court, but it's not on the internet.
But it's not on the internet. So we have only to do a reading.
Okay, so which part do I get to play?
Well, you can decide. I'll tell you that most of the speaking part is Rahm.
Oh, we should get Dennis in there. He does a very good Rahm imitation.
Does he?
But whatever. Yeah, that's a whole... Dennis, the producer of my radio show.
Would he do it?
Oh, well, let's see.
All right.
Hold on.
Yes.
what's going on?
I'm returning your call.
I'm going to get, my guys are looking at this, and I got to get the final legal document. But in the meantime, you should know, bizarrely, in my interest of, you know, having somebody there, you know, that doesn't want to make it a lifetime commitment.
Correct.
There's a lot of committeemen.
Right.
All of a sudden, all the aldermen and committeemen don't want to do this job. Before, they couldn't give a shit, you know?
Right, right.
I mean, who the fuck is the congressman?
Right.
And now they want to do it. Forrest Claypool, bizarrely, would like to be considered, and he says he only wants to do it for, like, one term or two max.
Yeah.
And then he wants to go to the cabinet.
Yeah, no, I...
And he's doing it.
I predicted that. That's a good play. So how could I help? I'll help you. What can I do?
Okay, well, here's what I need you to do is I'm going to get the legal thing answered, but I...
My lawyers tell me we can't do that, but I hope you could find another way.
That you can't do what?
I can't appoint it. I can't appoint. It has got to be a special election, but if...
No, both cases. No, they are not wrong. Both cases are special. But one situation is if I do step down before this term is up.
Okay.
Remember, the next Congress is 100. It's January 4th. Get sworn in.
Okay.
Let's just play argument and say I step down December 17th.
Right.
Or 14th, or whatever it is.
Okay.
Okay? You would want to appoint somebody to finish those 3 weeks.
I'm happy to appoint your guy. If I could do it, I'll do it.
And then he... And he gets, you know, all we're giving him is 3 weeks of a head start.
Right.
But it does give him, it's not like Forrest doesn't have a name or anything like that. It gives him a head start and a presumption. So I'm going to check that legally out. And then when this is between you and I,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
All right. Before, as we talked on the phone,
yeah.
I will not forget this.
Yeah, no.
I appreciate it. That's all I'm going to say. I don't want you to go, and you and I shouldn't go farther.
Right, exactly. So this speaks to the relationship between Claypool and Emanuel, you know, going as far back as 2008, that you don't have to read too far between the lines to see that Claypool pretty much was going to, you know, do whatever Rahm said and just like be a placeholder congressman.
Right.
And Rahm would come right back in.
By the way, for what it's worth, Claypool later denied that he was even privy to this.
Did he really?
Yeah. Okay. Again, this tape of this conversation that Dennis and Dave just dramatically read was played at Blagojevich's trial. And so that's when it was revealed. So I forget when that was, but it was sometime after the actual phone conversation. And Claypool denied that he had agreed to step down or anything. You have to find the clip. So always credibility issues there with Forrest Claypool.
Well, just for some historical perspective, let's look back at the appointees, the mayoral appointees of heads of Chicago public schools.
Great idea.
And the year we should start, of course, is?
1995.
Absolutely, because that's when the state allowed a change to the way that the heads of Chicago public schools are made.
Yeah.
Just for some civics lesson here for the listeners, Broward, Illinois school district boards of education appoint what's called the superintendent in most of Illinois. Mm-hmm. But in 1995, the General Assembly gave the mayor of Chicago, then Mayor Richard Daley, the power to be able to appoint on his own.
Well, the mayor always had the power to appoint, but what had happened, and this is really getting in the weeds of Chicago superintendent lore, I can't believe I still remember this, much less I know this.
It's seminal.
But we had decentralization in 1989. We had two phases of quote-unquote reform. The first one was decentralization.
That created local school councils.
Created local school councils, and the way it worked would be that the local school councils, they had a governing body of members of local school councils, would select, I think it was three candidates, potential school board appointees, and they would present those candidates to the mayor, and the mayor would choose one of the three. And so in that regard, the mayor had choice, but he had to work in conjunction with the local school councils. In 1995, the state, and I was Governor Edgar at the time, decided they should give more power to the mayor. They gave all the power to appoint to Mayor Daley, and that in those days was Mayor Daley, and Mayor Rahm has, of course, inherited that power.
And we've had seven, they're now called chief executive officers rather than superintendents. We've had seven since then in the 22 years since then, the first of whom...
Let me see if I can do this.
I've got the list.
All right. You have a list. I do not have a list, ladies and gentlemen. I'm without a net. Okay. Dave's got a net.
Go for it, Ben.
Let's see. The first CEO of the Chicago, the newly revamped.
We just talked about him last time.
Pablo Paul Avalos.
Who was what in the Daley administration?
Well, he was the revenue director for Daley.
He was
probably
director,
the guy who invented the TIFs. I think he was one of the guys in the mayor's office who figured out, boss, if we take this economic development tool and just apply it absolutely everywhere, whether it's needed or not, we'll get millions and millions of dollars in property tax dollars. We could spend any way we want.
I'd like him as lieutenant governor.
Yeah, well, that was Pat Quinn's unfortunate decision. But anyway, so yes, he was Mayor Daley's first CEO of the public schools.
So the next one should be easy.
Yeah, when he left, when Daley removed Paul Vallis, he replaced him with Arne Duncan.
2001.
Very good. Excellent for knowing that.
So as we go through these, it goes back and forth between whether these people have any experience in education. So Paul, just to back up to Paul Vallis, Paul Vallis did not have...
Well, in defense of Paul Vallis, he did go to school.
I mean professional experience.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. He went to grade school, and he went to high school, and so, you know, that's got to count for something.
But he was not an educator.
No, he was not an educator, and his background was, yes, in finances, municipal finances, and he's a bureaucrat, basically.
Whereas Arne Duncan taught basketball, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, Arne Duncan had a little more of a connection to education. He was not a teacher, but he worked for Paul Vallis. He was in charge of, I want to say, special programming or magnet schools or something like that.
So he came out of the central office.
Yeah, he came out of the central. So he was a bureaucrat, and he got along really well. He was a very skillful diplomat and mediator of sorts. He could go into a room where there were people with strong opinions on opposite sides of an issue and sort of, you know, delicately, deftly maneuver his way around. I think that was his strongest.
And he was there for a long time. He was there for 8 years.
Yeah, he was there for 8 years, and then he left when Barack Obama appointed him
the Secretary of Education.
That is correct. So who replaced Arne Duncan?
I'll give you a clue. Police Department.
Oh, yeah. Ron Huberman. How can I forget? Ron Huberman. I did so many Ron Huberman stories. Here's another guy. No, one more time. He did go to school, but he had never had any experience in public education, running a public school. Not an educator. And he was the police department as like a lower level guy in charge of keeping track of statistics or something. And wait, didn't he go to the CTA first?
He headed the CTA, similar to Claypool.
Similar. They sent him over to the CTA because they figured nobody could screw it up over there. The thing runs itself. And then they go, oh, look, he's got experience. Now we'll have him run the schools.
Which he did for only a year.
Well, first of all, he was very controversial. He really upset a lot of people, including the teachers. What happened was that Mayor Daley decided he wasn't going to run for re-election, and the idea was that the new mayor would get to appoint whoever he or she wanted. Remember, there's a woman running as well. So there was an interim appointee, and I believe for 10 trivial points, his name was Terry Mazzani.
Very good. Chicago Community Trust.
Yeah, Chicago Community Trust. He was a member of the civic community in Chicago, and he was just, I always joke that it was like the golden age of education in Chicago, where Mazzani didn't do anything. It's like, oh, man, just don't do anything, and it'll be better than doing something.
The people whose opinion I respected Mazzani as a choice and wished that he had gone on to become the permanent CEO.
Well, you know, I mean, if he'd become the permanent, he would probably have to do one of two things. He would either have to do the stupid things that a mayor told him to do, or he'd have to stand up to the mayor and he would be fired. So pick your choice.
It would have been interesting.
Yeah, it would have been interesting.
So he lasted for a year, and then Mayor Emanuel chose...
Oh, man, Jean-Claude Brizard. He brought him in from Rochester. He did a whole nationwide, international search. I got to find the perfect guy to run the Chicago public schools. And he went to Rochester, New York. I don't know what the hell, what he was thinking. And
he was an educator. He did run a school district in Rochester.
But he knew nothing about Chicago, which is, you know, a whole other issue. Should the person who runs the Chicago public schools know something about Chicago?
He said subsequently that he felt that he wasn't actually running, words to this effect, that he wasn't actually running the schools, that the mayor had his inside people, one of whom was the chief communications officer for CPS, Becky Carroll.
Oh, my good friend, Becky Carroll. Listen, no superintendent runs the schools. They are appointees of the mayor. They're puppets of the mayor. The reason Daley let Vallis go, as you recall, going back to our first, is because Daley felt that Vallis was trying to take too much credit for the good things that were being done, if there were any good things at all. And the job of a superintendent is to deflect, give all the credit to the mayor, and then assume all the blame, and that's the job of a superintendent, and to say things like, the mayor is really smart and well-read and coming up with good ideas. That's the job of a superintendent. So Jean-Claude, I guess he wasn't used to that in Rochester, where he got to be the man in charge of the schools. And so he lasted for
18 months, maybe.
18 months, and they blamed the teacher strike on it. Somehow or other, they blamed the teacher strike on
it. Well, he was on vacation for part of the strike. Am I correct in that? Does that sound familiar?
I can't remember that. I just know that by the time the strike occurred, he had lost so much standing with Mayor Rahm that they didn't even pretend that he was having a role in the negotiations of a contract. Yeah. So his successor was positioned as the person who was doing the heavy lifting on the contract.
And that person is
Barbara Bird Bennett.
Triple B.
Triple B. And that was the funny thing, because Mayor Rahm was going through this bizarre little phase of existence where he gave nicknames to his school superintendents. So I think he called Brizard J.C.
He did.
J.C., J.C., you know, like they were buddies. Meanwhile, he was throwing them out the door. And then he was like, B3, B3, you know, Brizard Bird Bennett. Of course, we all know what happened with
She is now living in Club Fed.
Yeah, she was the one, and, you know, we've talked about this many, many times. She was the one who was engineering a deal with a principal's consulting firm. They teach principals how to be principals, like talk about wasting money. They were going to get contracts to train principals, and then they were going to kick the money back to her. And they had actually talked about this on email, and the feds were listening to Rahm promise Forrest Claypool. That's where we started. Now the feds are reading the emails.
Yeah, they didn't even have to tap her line. They just read the
emails. Yeah, they just read the emails.
And to her credit, she was a professional educator. She came out of a school system.
Yeah, she was in Detroit for a while. I always say that Mayor Rahm had reason to believe, and his people had reason to believe, that she was up to no good, but they looked the other way because they needed her to be the public face on the closing of all those schools. She was a black woman, and they needed her to be the one who announced that it was in the best interest of black children that they closed these 50 schools. Maybe you recall when the 50 schools, when the announcement came down that the 50 schools were being closed, Mayor Rahm was on a skiing trip in Utah, and it was Barbara Bird Bennett who closed the schools. And then shortly thereafter, somewhere in that time period, the Board of Education approved a $20 million contract to the consulting firm. Yeah. So I've always thought there was some kind of, Mayor Rahm was looking the other way. You know what I'm saying?
This point that you made earlier around the CEO not being the person to run the school, do you think that's actually true with a couple of these guys? Like, for example, Claypool, as evidenced by the phone call that we just had the traumatic reading of, he is trusted by the mayor. And it feels to me like the policies that are being carried out in terms of school closings that are happening now or that are imminent, or student-based budgeting, per-pupil-based budgeting, these are being carried out by Claypool. He's an effective manager. In other words, he is actually carrying this stuff out. He's not a puppet. He's the guy that's doing it. That's my impression.
Well, listen, I think that there's a sort of general guidelines that he's following that Mayor Rahm has given him, and that he does, to your point, yes.
He's in charge.
Wield a lot of power.
But he's not making those choices.
No,
those choices are being made for him.
If he were to suddenly say, you know what? I don't want to close schools in Englewood. I kind of like been reading Ben Jarofsky's columns. And you know what? I think it would be a good idea to take that TIF money that we're going to give to Amazon and instead spend it in school, because Ben makes a compelling point.
And then we'd have the eighth CEO.
Yeah, we have the eighth CEO. So he knows enough not to, you know, he knows what they want him to do, and he does it. And he's very arrogant. I've written stories about how nasty he was to Alderman Susan Sadlowski Garza. And he's just sort of got this arrogant swagger of a guy who knows that he's, you know, got the support of the big guy. So he doesn't have to fear anything. And that is so evident in what we started talking about, this whole interplay where he feels he's above the inspector general. The inspector general is in charge of rooting out, you know, conflicts of interest and waste, et cetera, et cetera. And Forrest Claypool, you know, was just feels like, I don't have to answer to you. I don't have to answer your questions.
He strikes me as kind of a utility player, where the Cook County and the Chicago Democratic establishment select people like him because they know they will play the game. These people that they select will play the game.
Well, you know, it's interesting about Forrest Claypool. I followed his career for a while now. We're about the same age. We arrived in town about the same time. He met Rahm when they were both operatives, along with David Axelrod, for, I want to say, Paul Simon, former senator, U.S. Senator Paul Simon. They were all very young.
That's a pretty good pedigree.
Yeah, they were political operatives.
Where did they go wrong?
Yeah, where did they go wrong? And then he got his start. I first met Forrest Claypool, I want to say, maybe I didn't meet him. I heard about him. He worked for Pat Quinn at the Cook County Board of Review. He was one of his aides. So he had an in through Quinn. He had an in through Axelrod. He worked his way up. He was an aide, a chief of staff to Mayor Daley. In the 90s, there was the birth of the TIFFs. It was Vallis and Claypool figuring, hey, boss, we can really, what a scam this is. But at some point, he wanted to be the man. If you recall, he ran for
public county
office.
Board president.
Well, he was elected to commissioner of the county board first. And then from that position, he was a very sharp critic of John Stroger because this is the key. Forrest Claypool, having worked for Mayor Daley for all those years, went over to the county board and suddenly realized, oh my God, there's waste and patronage in government. Somehow or other, he didn't see it at the city level when it was Mayor Daley. He dutifully worked for Daley as his chief of staff without seeing any waste, without seeing any patronage, without seeing any corruption. But he went over to the county board where there was a black man running the show, and all of a sudden he found waste, patronage, ineffectiveness. He goes, I'm outraged. I'm shocked.
Do you think it's that simple, racism?
Absolutely. We've had this conversation before, haven't we?
Not about Claypool, no.
Well, it's beyond Claypool. It's the citizens of Chicago. Yeah. I mean, I personify it with Claypool, but I think he just symbolizes a larger situation. Whereas, I'll just say this, that white people looked the other way at waste, corruption, and ineffectiveness under Mayor Daley and got outraged when they saw John Stroger doing that. And double outrage when Todd Stroger did it. And oh my God, what happened when Stroger went into the coma and engineered the machinations that got Todd put in? You know, I mean, I think that there's a double standard. Absolutely, there's a double standard. People put up, they elected Daley year after year after year, election after election, I should say, and they didn't seem to object. The North Side reformers didn't seem to object. All the waste in the pager, hired truck, all the affirmative action violations that took place. I forget all these. It's been so long, Dave, but 2003, there were so many corruption trials. They resoundingly reelected Daley. You know, yeah. This is about the time that Forrest Claypool was railing against Stroger. So I guess this is before we started doing our podcast, but this is one of my favorite themes for a while, about 2006 or so. Hey, come on, this ain't fair. Why are you so mad at Stroger? Okay, all right, be mad at Stroger. Fair enough. What about Daley?
So we have what I like to call clots of clout, where we have fiefdoms, if you will. And in very broad strokes in Chicago, we have what you just described as sort of white establishment and perhaps racist fiefdoms and centers of clout centered around people like Richard Daley and Alderman Ed Burke. Then we have Black Chicago. We have other centers of clout, like arguably Secretary of State Jesse White and Congressman Danny Davis. You know, the list can go on. So I'm just thinking out loud here that these people have to coexist, and they sort of carve up the turf and essentially agree to go along, except when things like what you just described happen, where Claypool goes on the county board and decides, you know what, I'm going to start interfering with your turf.
And I find it really irritating, and I'll tell you why. All the time Mayor Daley was mayor, he was getting praised by the mainstream press on many fronts, but one front was improving race relations. Hmm. And they would always say, well, when he first ran, I don't know, 60% of black voters voted against him. And by the time he was leaving office, I'm making these numbers up, I can't remember the exact numbers, like he was winning almost all the black wards. Race relations have improved under Mayor Daley. That was the consensus. And I always say, well, I don't know if they've improved. I know that black voters are alienated. I know that black voters are apathetic. I know that there's frustration among black voters. They're not voting. The turnout is falling. But there's also support for Daley. And that support is in part because Daley struck a very crucial alliance with John Stroger. And John Stroger was the man at the county who provided jobs for black committeemen, black aldermen, black politicians. And so I just found it really bizarre that Forrest Claypool and the other quote-unquote Northside Reformers, and that is very much in quotes, Northside Reformers, the North Side is the least important part of the quotes, would be critical of John Stroger, who was actually the guy responsible for improving the race relations, that again, all credit goes to Daley.
So it's like Claypool slipped his leash.
Stroger bashing was a very effective foil for Daley because that put the attention on Stroger. So
a diversion.
If Northside Reformers, you know, like a Forrest Claypool, wanted to really show, flex their reforming muscle, they could say, pox on John Stroger. And then they would just concentrate on Stroger as though Mayor Daley wasn't up to anything.
It might have been Kabuki theater.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it could be. It's a Chicago form of Kabuki theater.
I'm saying that Claypool might have just staged the whole thing, and he was a faux reformer, and just to do what you just said, to create a diversion.
Well, I'll put it this way. He established quite a career for himself. You know what? Richard Steele, a good friend of mine.
Former WBZ host.
One time I was driving my car, I heard Richard interviewing Forrest Claypool, and this is when Claypool was just about to run against Stroger, I want to say. And Claypool was talking about all the waste at the county, and he was really concerned about poor people. His main concern was the poor people. And Richard, that was as hard as I've ever... Richard just came down on him hard, wouldn't let him off, because he knew what game
Claypool
was
playing.
And I was, oh, yeah, Richard, give it to him. Because the mainstream media, by and large, went along with it. Oh, you know. And the Tribune, they railed against Stroger. Oh, my God, Stroger, Stroger, Stroger. Now they do that to Berrios, 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 Berrios. It's like the only corrupt people in the city of Chicago. It's funny how this works. Black people and Puerto Ricans. But somehow, like the white guys that run the thing, well, they're all reformers. You know, Router's a reformer. Rahm's a reformer. There's this like a double standard that's just like embedded in their way of looking at the world. And Forrest Claypool and Rahm are beneficiaries of that. But Claypool, he lost. He couldn't beat Stroger, even though John Stroger was in a coma. And then he ran, I don't know if you remember this, he ran for assessor against Berrios, couldn't beat Berrios. And so he said, forget it. No more running for office. I'll just go be...
utility player.
Yeah. And so he goes to the CTA, and now he's at the Board of Education, and he does whatever the boss says.
Well, Ben, that's all we have time for. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, sir.
Listeners, you know, we always welcome your questions and comments and suggestions for future interviews. You can find us on Facebook by going to InsideGov. That's Inside G-O-V. You can email us at contact@shygov.com. I'm Dave Glowatz. Thanks for listening.